Hey everyone out there, and thanks for joining us again here at ASAP Nowcast, the podcast for ASAP Now. As you know, ASAP Now is both in print and in your mailboxes, as well as online at asapnow.com. And on the podcast each month, we try to do a deeper dive on one topic. And this month, it's a doozy. It's waiting room medicine. Now, waiting room medicine, we all know it, we all do it. And the last time we discussed this was actually April 2023 with a debate with myself and Dr. Luke Labath, and I did the exact take of what we should do when faced with either accepting imperfection and trying to improve it and make it reasonable for our patients, or Dr. Labath's standpoint that we should staunchly say no because poor care is worse than no care. Now, since then, waiting room medicine has only continued to spread in emergency medicine. And the reason, of course, is ED boarding. Now, ED boarding is a misnomer because it's really inpatient boarding in the ED. But even that is a misnomer because that's really a reaction to other issues holding up discharges in the hospital, whether that's lack of resources for SNFs and LTACs, insurance approvals, or all sorts of other societal ailments outside of healthcare. Because we are all in this big ecosystem of two little resources trying to squeeze some palatable outcomes out of it. So this month in the magazine, we have an interesting take on waiting room medicine with several authors from the ASAP Ethics Committee. So check it out as we interview one of their authors, Dr. Liz Claiborne. Hey everyone at ASAP Now, thanks again for joining us. We have this month a great feature on the ASAP Now magazine article, Waiting Room Medicine, The Ethical Conundrum. And with us today is one of its authors, Dr. Liz Claiborne, who is an emergency medicine physician at University of Maryland Capital Region Medical Center in Largo, Maryland. So Liz, thanks again so much for joining us to talk about this article.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to discuss it.
Now, I think waiting room medicine is something that is near and dear to all of our hearts and something we have probably all done. So I want to just kick it off by just understanding how you and the authors all got together to write this and what was the motivating thought, because it was quite a few of you. It's for those who don't have the article in front of them, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 different authors across Oklahoma, Mississippi, Seattle, Iowa, Ohio that all, you know, came together to come up with this article. What was the motivating factor?
Well, we're all members of the ASAP Ethics Committee, and I was the lead author on this, meaning I corralled all those colleagues of mine into getting together to discuss this problem, and it was one of the listed objectives. So every year, the Ethics Committee is sent a list of objectives that's reviewed by the board, where we really do kind of in-depth research and then push out publications across a variety of ethics issues, and this is certainly one that was top of mind. So me and everyone that was a part of this particular objective got together to really understand what are the main issues that are at the, you know, core and foundation of leading to waiting room medicine's problems. Where do we see ethical issues that interface with those problems? And then what are the potential solutions, right? Like, what can we do about it? Since we all know that it is very much a problem that we face on the front lines every day.
And I love the assessment of issues you guys had. And it makes sense now that you framed it from the thought process of ethics. Now, I don't want to focus here too much because, like I said, I think most emergency physicians are very familiar with the downsides of waiting room medicine. But can you walk me through briefly how you guys thought about it with privacy, liability, patient experience?
Yeah, so we first looked at like what we think from an ethical perspective were the primary issues that emergency physicians face when dealing with treating patients in the waiting room, from the standpoint that they are not really able to perform to the highest expectations or standards of medicine because of the situation that they're in trying to take care of people with the fewer resources. And we outlined what we thought were three of the primary concerns, which is first, privacy, right? That's probably in your face. Like when you are taking care of a patient and they're in a hallway or they're in a chair or they're sitting in the waiting room even, and you're having to talk to them, you are not doing any of the things that you were taught as a resident is standardized in taking care of a patient, meaning that they're, you know, fully undressed in a row, a gown, and that they're in a private room where you're going to be able to have a conversation about what's going on with optimal settings. All of that's really out the window. And I would say the majority of emergency physicians are used to talking to people who are usually fully clothed, sitting right next to another person who may or may not be related to them, and sometimes having to kind of discuss really sensitive issues. And while maybe this doesn't seem like it's a big idea if you're dealing with something like an ankle sprain or, you know, some kind of musculoskeletal injury, if someone's there for an STD check or they're having an issue with a miscarriage or something that's much more personal, like a psychological issue, then this is something that is very much a problem, that they don't have the privacy they needed. And as you know, one of the biggest tenets of our Hippocratic Oath was in the profession of medicine, that we needed to be able to respect patients and their privacy. And so by the very nature of having to treat people in the waiting room, that is taken away from us and something that we can't accomplish. And then the second big thing that we were able to outline is that we think that there's pretty significant harm that's done to the physician-patient relationship, both because now they don't have that privacy, it erodes the foundation of trust that can be established in a short period of time between a physician and patient. And then on top of that, just the dynamics of having to wait for prolonged periods of time also harms the physician-patient relationship, which we all know is integral to getting, you know, valid information quickly, being able to follow up with the patient and give them the best recommendations, because they were maybe expecting to come into the ER, and data shows us that most people are underestimating the amount of time that they will spend in an ER when they come in. So from jump, they're arriving there and their expectations are not being met. The longer they're in the waiting room or the longer they're in the emergency department overall, and that means that there's more amount of time that they're there, but it doesn't mean that there's any additional time that they're seeing the physician. So that proportion of time that they're seeing a doc versus a time in the department is really erosive to the relationship, because they feel like they're being ignored a lot. And even if you have other staff members coming in, the nurse or a student or someone updating them, the patients are very focused on how much time they spent with the doctor. And so, you know, waiting room medicine to that extent really erodes that trust and that relationship, which I think is a core tenet of having, you know, the ability to provide excellent care. And then the third thing, which, you know, for a lot of people, this is their primary concern, is that there's a liability issue with waiting room medicine. A lot of people asked us, like, so if I go see somebody out in the waiting room, does that establish the physician-patient relationship? Like, I am now liable for that patient, and let's say they elope or they walk out or they leave without completing their treatment. Is it going to create liability that would not otherwise be there if I just waited until they were brought back to a room? And for those reasons, some physicians will just not go into the waiting room at all, because they just think, well, I'm putting myself at legal risk. And what we found is that the law is very muddled in telling us the extent of liability. INTALA means that we do need to have some kind of examination that establishes that the patient is stabilized and appropriate for either transfer or continued care there. And a lot of times that is happening right when they check in. So a lot of facilities where there might be a brief interaction with a physician or mid-level in the triage area may or may not establish care for that patient. Historically, what you'll see if there is a suit, everybody is named in the suit, but ultimately, you know, they're usually not accounted for or held liable. They usually come after the institution, the hospital overall, which puts a lot of pressure on the hospital to fix these systems and make it better to care for patients. But at the same time, we all know that nobody wants to get sued. So you never want to be in a position where you're heightening that ability to open yourself up for having kind of legal issues. But the converse of that is not seeing people at all in the waiting room. And that brings us back to that ethical foundation. What is the worst thing to do, right? Is it more beneficent to make sure you're at least seeing somebody to make sure there's nothing serious going on, or wait until they come back? And for all these reasons, it's really a cobweb of, you know, an ethical conundrum and what we should do, what's best for the patients, what's best for you as a physician, and what's best for the overall healthcare system.
Yeah. And so a couple of years ago on this podcast, myself and one of the other board members, Dr. Labaz, actually debated that exact thing of, should we do waiting room medicine at all? With the yes answer being like, hey, life is imperfect. Let's be a team player and do what we can to see patients, even though it's in imperfect situations in the waiting room, rather than just letting them sit out there not being seen. And the converse is like, hey, if we see them in these suboptimal scenarios, A, we're not, you know, really providing them appropriate care, but then also B, does it decrease the pressure for the hospital to help us? So I'm super curious, just among the cohort of your authors, did everyone kind of agree on whether we should implement some of the solutions that we'll get into in a second of basically accommodating waiting room medicine?
Yeah, I would say that the overall resounding answer is yes, that you have to treat patients in the waiting room, because there's also liability for letting people sit in the waiting room and not be treated. I actually had a patient a couple of months ago. We had a very prolonged wait. It was a younger guy, I believe in his 30s, and he was slightly tachycardic, maybe in the mid 110s, and had a little chest pain, but was otherwise healthy, no medical issues. And because, you know, he was pretty young, he kept getting skipped over for more acute patients. We had people coming in for ambo, and, you know, he's basically sitting out there forever. But a triage nurse came and said, look, I just think that this guy doesn't look good. Can you just lay eyes on him? And so someone went out to check on him, and he's like, no, I'm going to leave. I already called my family to come pick me up. And they're like, please just stay. We'd like to make sure nothing more serious is going on. Ultimately, he decided to stay, went outside to tell his family he was going to stay, and he collapsed when he went outside, had a massive PE, and had a cardiac arrest in front of the hospital. So that can be the consequence of not treating people in the waiting room. And that's the worst case scenario. And I think that that pulls at everyone's heartstrings, because ultimately, as ER docs, we're always primed to want to do the best for our patients, even though we're constantly in a resource poor environment. At the end of the day, there has to be a better, more supportive solution for all of us to do our jobs. And I don't think the solution has ever been to not see people. It's just a matter of how are we going to see people, and how are we going to lessen, you know, the threat to the patients and to the physicians' careers by allowing them to do what they can with the resources they have.
Yeah, and I love that, because I'm pretty staunchly in that camp. And even when I think about non-waiting room medicine, I've worked in multiple ERs where we call them curtain rooms, right? But the rooms are divvied up by curtains, so the privacy is okay at best. Some of the same patient relationship discussions you have apply here about waiting room medicine as those other kind of suboptimal care areas. So I agree also that we should do what we can to make the resources we have work for us. So I think where I really wanted to spend time was what you guys call solutions. So there's been lots and lots and lots of workflows and different strategies that you guys review to help mitigate waiting room medicine and make it a little bit easier to work with, and of course better for patients. Can you walk us through just a couple of those that you found really helpful?
Yeah, we looked at a number of resources that kind of had evaluated the landscape for effective solutions for this kind of waiting room strategy. And one of the most common things that are brought up are this nurse-driven standardized triage order sets. So I know that some people love order sets and some people don't, because you're like, why did you order that? Or I wouldn't have done that. But ultimately, we do see a lot more efficiency and ability to kind of move patients forward without them having their initial exam done by the physician when they check in and order sets are used. And so it also is usually more effective when you can put a provider up in triage. So another solution was to put either a mid-level or a physician, more of an advanced care provider, in the triage space, where they can be a little bit more nuanced with deciding how to order. So they're not fully seeing patients, but they're kind of doing advanced order sets and turning through people quickly. And the other thing that does is it helps you to catch very sick people who may on paper not, you know, necessarily meet the qualifications for being able to be brought back immediately, but you have someone have eyes on them that has more experience so they can facilitate that. So that, you know, brings that risk down. The other things that a lot of us are familiar with are obviously having additional resources in the ED, like, you know, point of care testing, especially for UAs and troponins, so that you're not waiting on lab turnaround, which can really slow things down. Having frequent vitals done, both for the inpatients or the patients boarding in the ER, the patients who are waiting potentially to be admitted, and the waiting room. I think that was one of the biggest issues, is when people are waiting in the waiting room, they may have a change in their status, but we don't have eyes on that. And so one of the solutions was that we need to be having someone at least gather basic vitals for everybody who is in the waiting room, which can reduce the propensity for us to miss a patient like the one I mentioned that was sitting in our waiting room with a massive PE that we didn't know about. Other things that I think have some teeth to it is obviously having observation units. A couple of my facilities at University of Maryland have observation units that are run by ER physicians, where we really can kind of seamlessly move someone over. That way we're not waiting for them to either go up to observation or be shipped out somewhere else. And then additional resources in the department, such as scribes, mental health providers, and pharmacists. Those are all things that can add to flow and throughput that allow us to be more effective and therefore, you know, bring down some of our waiting times. But as you know, the biggest issue with waiting room medicine is not usually the front door and how effective we're churning through the new patients. It's the back door, right? It's the patients that are waiting to be admitted and the amount of boarding that we're really being able to tolerate. That is what really backs up the ED. And while some of these things help with the backdoor issue, I do think that they really don't get at the heart or the meat of the issue, which is that we are boarding. And that is why we have a lot of wait time.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point, because in all of your non-traditional care models or solutions you mentioned, they are in some way related to other departments, right? Whether it's pharmacy or, hey, labs if they could turn over faster, of course, inpatient if they could create more rooms, social work if they could find dispositions, or mental health if they could help find resources for patients they didn't need to stay in the ER. It just feels like, you know, the next door is always the problem. What I mean, it's like the front door is us, right? So we're like, well, it backs up, and that's because of the inpatient. Inpatient says, hey, it's backed up because we can't discharge the SNFs or LTACs. LTACs say, hey, we are stuck because of, you know, insurance or social work or case management or, you know, whatever it is. And it just seems that a lot of the boarding we have is certainly not just an ER department, but it may not even just be a simple inpatient problem, you know, like it's kind of ancillary services, resources in the community, even especially for placement, like those sort of things.
Absolutely. Because if you look at why we're boarding and why they can't actually get people upstairs, it's because maybe they're not discharging because they don't have the resources they need to discharge and they're understaffed on the floor. As you said, there's not the community resources to get people out of the hospital on time. So it really is a systemic issue. It's just that, as we know, everything rolls downhill into the ER, and that's really where the belly of all the problems is. And we are often dealing with the most acute issues there that are really kind of a consequence of everything that's happening in the overall healthcare system. I always say that emergency medicine is like the canary in the coal mine, and it just seems like it's always going off. Like there's always an issue with our healthcare system, and you'll continue to see, I think, the exacerbation of our resources and further stress on ER physicians because we're being pushed to practice medicine in which we weren't trained, right? We were not trained to practice the way we are. And so really the fundamental, I think, tenet of this whole article is that we are really choosing between the lesser of two evils, doing nothing, which I don't think any of us want to do, and doing something that may be risky, but is the best we can do with the resources we have. And while I think that a lot of us are happy to do that, and you know, a lot of us are always going out of our way to provide the best medicine we possibly can, it's not something that's sustainable over time. And so at the end, we really had a call to action that while some of these solutions can temporize the problem, fundamentally, there has to be some government and systemic overhaul with policy that gets at the root of this issue. And that if we continue just putting a Band-Aid on this problem, in some ways, we might be actually prolonging the necessity for them to create a solution. So there were some authors that said, hey, maybe we should stop doing some of these things all the time because they're not really getting that this is a problem that is ultimately going to break the system in the long run.
And I would love to talk more about the call to action, because you mentioned how ASAP is calling for and is actually participating in a seminar on eating boarding with CMS. It's so hard for me sometimes to visualize what are regulatory or government changes that would improve boarding, because it feels so local. Like, I know there have been states that have mandated things like the no waiting room emergency department, and the response from it was like, hey man, this is an unfunded mandate. We don't know how we're going to make this happen. I would love to hear a little more detail, if you're able to, on what are some of the government regulations, policies, asks we have to help with ED boarding.
Yeah, so I think that the first is that they always are trying to designate ED boarding as an ED problem. And one of the things they want to do is transfer that responsibility to a hospital and basically health system problem, right? It is not a problem of the emergency department. It is a problem of the hospital and that healthcare system. Because as we said, it's not a matter of us dealing with the front door. It's the back door that's creating the waiting room. And if you talk to a lot of politicians or people on the Hill, I don't think they actually conceptualize that is the issue with waiting room medicine. I think they make an issue akin to the ER because they're like, well, it's happening in the ER. So it's an ER problem. So I think first it's like explaining like where the, you know, source of the problem is coming from, it being the hospital, and then putting the actual resources behind the hospital being able to have that. So I do think overall, we know, you know, the issue is that we're understaffed largely, especially in nursing across like all hospital spaces. And that's one of the primary issues that they have with boarding in the ER and getting people admitted and discharged frequently. So I think that there's some educational things that could happen in increasing the number of professionals that are going into the healthcare space. I also think that people have underestimated how fragile we are since COVID. You know, we're about 5 years out now, which is hard to believe from the COVID-19 pandemic, but that really fractured our workforce within emergency medicine in particular. And several of us are just still licking our wounds. And so really, I don't think that we've actually gotten back to the staffing levels and resources that we need to operate efficiently since the pandemic. And any other, you know, kind of influx of patients or measles outbreaks or anything else that could happen, I think could really tip the scales. And so from a policy standpoint, I think it's understanding that we're nearly fractured and that it's a serious call to arms. There has to be resources put into supporting the entire hospital, specifically with being able to efficiently admit and then discharge patients so there can be better throughput through the emergency department.
Absolutely. I think that's just such a compelling and eloquent way that you put that, of why it is that we need to be heard, need to be part of the voice that people in power can make some of these changes. So Dr. Claiborne, I want to thank you so much for coming on with us and talking about this article, because it's so important and so core to the health delivery that we give literally every day. So thank you.
Thanks for having me. And I encourage everyone, like, this is where you have an opportunity to reach out to your representative, participate in, you know, ASAP and your other professional organizations so that you make sure your voice is heard. Because so often we assume things that we think are common sense that other politicians and policymakers understand, and they really don't. And they will not get it unless we make our voice heard. So please be active. Please share articles like this, share your perspective, and share your stories.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much. Call to action. That's my biggest takeaway here. Change can happen. As a piece of good news that we didn't cover in the article, but I think is worth mentioning here, is that LeapFrog, the safety organization, recently added boarding as a key hospital measure in ranking safety nationally. Now, this is monumental in a couple ways, because one, they cite ASAP as a reason for including this, and that is all of our voices. Two, they renamed the measure not ED boarding, but hospital boarding in the ED. And three, they are the first national ranking to have this metric as something to be reported that reflects on the safety of the hospital. Now, while it is optional in 2025, it is still a step in the right direction to be able to publicly report and rank and compare hospitals on this exact measure. From their release policy, they have this statement. Boarding patients in the ED after the decision to admit them to an inpatient bed is a long-standing yet increasingly common quality and safety issues. Studies suggest boarding patients in the ED is associated with delayed and missed care, medication errors, higher morbidity, in-hospital mortality, extended hospital length of stay, and poor patient satisfaction. Now, if that doesn't sound just like the voice of emergency medicine physicians, I don't know what is. And it's a great piece of good news that our voice is getting out there. So please get involved, share your voice, share your story, because it can make a difference. So there's a lot more for you in the magazine this month. This is it for us on this podcast for this month. But in the magazine, there's tons of clinical content. There is a great piece on hypertensive disorders in pregnancy and also eating disorder care in the ED, which I don't commonly think of. There's, of course, policy conversations. There is one about immigration status being asked in Texas hospitals, which is interesting as Texas is the state of both myself and our medical editor-in-chief, Dr. Dark. And there's also updates on ASEP's clinical policy on seizures and, of course, much, much more. As always, tweet us if you got an idea at ASEPNow or feel free to tweet me direct at Amy Faith Ho. We would love to hear your thoughts and feedback and keep you tuning in to the podcast. So thanks again, everyone, and see you all next month.